Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We live in tough times with serious problems at home and abroad. We're in the middle of a hyper-partisan and high-stakes presidential campaign where millions, maybe billions, will be spent on negative ads. No wonder we need a good laugh. It turns out we're also in the middle of a golden age of political satire, with millions tuning into Comedy Central for their daily dose of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and The Colbert Report. There's Bill Maher's weekly show on HBO, Late Night Comics, who routinely skewer politicians, and of course, The Onion. Well, today on Radio Times, we want to look at the history, the appeal, and the roots of political humor, and we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Allison Dagnes is an associate professor of political science at Shippensburg University, that's here in Pennsylvania, and she's the author of a new book called A Conservative Walks Into a Bar, The Politics of Political Humor. And Allison Dagnes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Danigal Young, and she's an assistant professor at the University of Delaware, where she's a fellow at the Center for Political Communication. She does improv, comedy improv, and she's also a contributor to FlackCheck.org at Penn Annenberg. And Dana, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Let me begin with a broad question, and Allison, I'll start with you. What positive role do you think comedy, satire, parody has played in our politics?
Well, it allows us to look at serious issues with a lighthearted way, and so it's a lot more fun than watching just the straight news. But at the same time that it brings us some joy, it also can educate us at times as well. And one great example of this is when Stephen Colbert established his super PAC. And going through the entire process of establishing a super PAC and then turning over financial control to Jon Stewart, he was able to highlight an extremely complicated issue in a way that was funny and entertaining, but also very educational at the same time.
And very disarming, I would say, as well.
Extremely.
Because things are so partisan and so divided, and people are in camps. I don't know if that's also true in the world of comedy as well.
Is to a certain degree, and a lot of I interviewed a bunch of conservative comedians for this book, and a lot of them feel, and perhaps rightly so, that there is a real lack of conservative political satire out there. And if you just take a quick look around, you can sort of see that that is true. But there are some reasons for that as well.
And I want to pick up on that. But Dana, let me get you in on the conversation. What role do you see comedy, satire, parody playing in our politics?
Well, what we know from media effects research, which is sort of a branch of social science where we either do experiments or surveys and study what mass media do to people, we've actually found that there are many positive outcomes as a function of exposure to political satire like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. And some of those outcomes we haven't necessarily pinpointed in terms of like a causal relationship, right. but we know for sure that there's an association between viewing these shows and, for example, being politically interested, paying a lot of attention to politics, discussing politics with friends and family, having high political efficacy, which is the feeling that you have a voice and that you can affect change. Mm. At the same time, though, we find low political trust among viewers of these shows, which, depending upon your point of view, could be a good thing, could be a bad thing, because it depends on if it's healthy skepticism or debilitating cynicism. But those are some of the things that we have identified.
But are you saying the audiences may trust Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert, but may not trust the people that they're skewering?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So the trust that I'm talking about really is trust in the government.
Right.
Like, can you trust the government and politicians to do what is right? And we see lower rates of that kind of trust among viewers of these shows, which, if you watch the shows, shouldn't be surprising.
No. Go ahead. Looks like you want to add something. Go ahead, Allison.
I do. That's actually several other scholars have done work in this area, and they have said that the downside to all of the satire is that it does breed cynicism, that the constant poking at our elected officials and our institutions of government is actually brings on something negative as well.
Yeah.
I've always thought, even beyond political humor, that there's always a sort of dark side to comedy. I mean, the person slipping on the banana peel, not so funny to them, funny to us. And there's right. That comedy is such a double-edged sword. And I'm asking, I guess, you, Dana, because you do comedy.
Right. I do improv comedy,
improv.
So I don't do any political satire per se. I mean, but I'll say what makes political humor is that there are people who are in positions of power and institutions that have power and influence. And part of what is our democratic right is to be able to speak out in ways that are critical of those people and institutions in power. And so you really wouldn't find any kind of satire that would be like, wow, the president is so great today. Isn't that fantastically funny that he's so fabulous today? Unless you are a Stewart or Colbert and you're ironically turning it upside down and mocking the fact that there isn't much to mock about the president on a good day.
Well, go ahead, Allison. Looks like you want to add something.
Just adding on to what Dana said, comedy is a complaint. You go back to, you know, take my wife, please. You know, you never say, my wife is great, but I'm bum. You know, there's nothing funny about that. And when you add the political to it, then this complaint certainly is anti-establishment. And that really is in the liberal wheelhouse. That's something that is definitely a leftist idea, that progress is better, change is better. Even if our guy is in office, we can still pick at him because there's got to be something better out there.
But also picking up what you both say is that perhaps political comedy slightly leans left because you're going after institutions. Mm-hmm. You're going after maybe conservative, in that broad sense, conservative ideas.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the things that makes it funny.
Right.
One of the things that satire is so good at is mocking the things that we hold, you know, most important to us, with this idea that change is possible, right, that we want to do something more, which may be a reason that conservatives may not be as comfortable with it.
Right. I heard Stephen Colbert in an interview back when he did interviews, like with students, I don't know when that was. I think it was at Harvard, and someone had asked, why are comics so liberal? And he had a decent response, mm-hmm, which was that the role of the satirist is to challenge the status quo, which is an inherently liberal phenomenon. I think that there are other levels to it, which I can get into later, mm-hmm, but I think fundamentally that's true.
Mm-hmm. It's the jester speaking truth to the king. You know, that's what I heard over and over again.
Well, and you also said, Allison, you talked to some, you didn't get to talk to Dennis Miller, although I know
not.
That you tried, but you talked to some other conservative comics or comedians, mm-hmm, and they express some kind of frustration, I guess, that they haven't either found their audience or their politics don't exactly work.
They
when it comes
did.
To comedy or
yeah,
satire?
They were very frustrated. And all of them, to a person, said that there was a bias in the media, the larger media, that was a liberal bias, and it stopped them from getting up the ladder. There have been a lot of other research studies that have been done on this, and that really wasn't what I was focusing on. But they believed it to be true, and they pointed at a group in, I believe it's in Hollywood, and there's one in New York called Friends of Abe, which is where secret conservatives gather in the entertainment industry because they're so afraid of being outed.
Is that where you found all these conservative comics? Because when I started looking at your book, I'm like, who are these people? And where did she find these people lurking? Because I find it very hard to find these. I mean, we talk about Dennis Miller, but a conservative comic, but...
It was cute. A lot of people said, oh, you should talk to Nick DiPaolo. You should talk to Nick DiPaolo. And my office phone rang, and I picked it up, and he said, hi, this is Nick DiPaolo. I heard you're looking for me. And
oh, wow.
I fell out of my chair. I was so excited. He was lovely, by the way. He was very sweet.
Well, speaking of Dennis Miller, I do want to play, it's about a minute, and this almost feels like ancient history, but this is back in around 2005. He's talking about the 2004 presidential election in one of his comedy specials. Let's listen to Dennis Miller.
Here's what it came down to me in the last election. I looked at the two men and I thought, John Kerry, good man. I've met him socially a couple times, fine man. And when I think about him as a 22-year-old boy of privilege going over to fight in that cluster to protect my rights, I just want to thank John Kerry for going to Vietnam. He could have slipped that in a second. God bless you. That is, to me, a far more inspirational thing than George Bush will ever do, including being the President of the United States. But, you know, that's exactly the same reason why I didn't vote for John Kerry. I think an experience like that in your formative years legitimately scars you, makes you a little reticent, makes you flinch. I think of John Kerry as a chess player. He examines every move on the board, every permutation of that move, every sequence of moves. But in the dangerous times we live, occasionally the egg timer goes off and you miss your turn. Conversely, Bush is a checkers player and he runs across an ass, he jumps him. And that's what we need right now.
And again, that's Dennis Miller speaking in 2005 about the 2004 presidential election. He begins by buttering up John Kerry and then telling us why he supports George Bush.
And that Dennis Miller was one of the reasons that I looked into all of this to begin with, because he, in the 1990s, just reached this sort of zenith of popularity. And one of the reasons that I liked him so much then was because he took aim at everybody, you know, the left and the right, and he was very biting. And that's what comedy is, just what you said. He builds him up and knocks him down.
Right.
And then after September 11th, he really became a very outspoken supporter of George W. Bush, and that was the line that he ran with. And so I think that this piece, the clip that you played, is really indicative of his support for George W. Bush, more so than him trying to be funny. And I think that that's a really important point to make, is that you can be funny when you set out to be funny. When you set out to be right, you may not be funny.
Oh, that's interesting. And I wonder, Dana, if, let's say, a Bush supporter listening to this might find that funny. A Kerry supporter probably wouldn't find that funny.
Probably. I mean, that's... It seems
Did you
like,
find that funny?
I can't tell you that, Marty, because I'm an objective scholar. The deal is...
That's funny.
In social science, we generally test stuff we already know to be true, but we use numbers, and then we're like, oh, look, here's a number. Here we have verification. So, yes, conservatives find jokes that mock liberals funny. Shocking, right. And vice versa. What is interesting about humor, though, is that used in the right context, it can also be disarming and reduce one's likelihood of arguing against the premise of an argument. So if used in a way that is not maybe as a direct weapon, you might be able to present an argument that's critical of a conservative position to a conservative audience in a way that would be less likely to get them angry and upset because it's through humor than it is in a serious way. You know, the whole it's just a joke phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. We're almost up on a break here, but people that I know that listen to Rush Limbaugh think he's hilarious. I mean,
right.
And they support him. They think he's hilarious. Those people who don't like Rush Limbaugh don't think there's anything funny about what he says. What does that tell us?
Well, I think Dana's going to speak to kind of the conservative and liberal minds, but I can tell you that the further out you are on the wings of the ideological spectrum, the less likely you're going to find the other wing to be funny at all.
Right.
And since most of us are really in the middle, any of this sort of outer wing humor is going to fall a little flat.
Right. I actually was talking with some fellow scholars of political communication at a conference last year, and I was trying to make this argument that I was developing at the time about the psychology of humor, and particularly of irony, and how I felt that irony, which is the tool of the satirist, which we can talk about, is definitely something that is allied with a liberal mind, and I can explain why. But they were arguing that there are conservative comics, but maybe we're looking in the wrong place. Maybe we should look at a Limbaugh or a Beck, because they are funny to people who listen to them.
Right.
And interestingly, a study that Allison talks a lot about in her book, which we can talk about after, the Ohio State study, was really revealing in terms of how it suggested different people process irony and satire differently.
Well, we'll pick up on that after this very short break. We're talking about political humor, satire, irony, parody, and our guests are Allison Dagnes and Danigal Young, and lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Do you find Rush Limbaugh funny? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Penn professor and geophysicist Douglas Jerelmack will discuss the implications of wetland loss in coastal Louisiana and prospects for the Mississippi Delta's future on Monday, September 24th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. on the Penn campus. The lecture is open to the public and is sponsored by Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies and the Master of Environmental Studies program, proud supporters of WHYY. Details can be found online by searching Penn MES.
This week on This American Life, our whole education system is organized around the idea that if you do well at tests, then you have learned what you need to be successful. So, how do you explain all the people who pass the standardized test just fine and then fail?
So you say something's missing. There's something out there in the universe that we're missing, and that dark matter, what could it be?
Finding that dark matter and what kids need this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
GOP candidate Mitt Romney's, as he put it, inelegant remarks about Obama voters' foreign policy and his father's Mexican roots are still making news. So we'll ask our panel of commentators in the beauty shop if it's just a curveball or a game changer. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the history, the appeal, the roots, the psychology of political humor. And our guests are Dana Young. She's an assistant professor at the University of Delaware, also a fellow at the Center for Political Communication. She teaches classes in politics and media effects. She also does improv comedy, and she works at Penn Annenberg, contributing to their factcheck.org site. Also with us is Allison Dagnes, and she's an associate professor of political science at Shippensburg University, and she's the author of a new book called A Conservative Walks Into the A Conservative Walks Into a Bar, The Politics of Political Humor. And we want to know what you find funny or who you find funny. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Allison, Dana mentioned before the break this Ohio study. Can you flesh that out for us?
Sure. Some scholars at Ohio State did a study where they asked a large group of people to listen to some of the Colbert Report, and they were self-identified as being either liberal or conservative. And what they found was that a significant number of the conservative viewers thought that Colbert was actually conservative. Mm-hmm. And so that leads to this phenomenon that's called confirmation bias, which is the idea that an idea is going to resonate more with you if you believe it to begin with.
Right.
And so that was just, I mean, sort of jaw-dropping to a whole bunch of folks on the left who said, oh, he's clearly mocking conservatives here. But it does show that we will like what we believe more than we will like something that challenges our pre-existing conditions.
And seek out those things that reinforce what we like
exactly.
and believe.
What was interesting about this study is that it was an experiment using undergraduates. Mm-hmm. So they actually randomly assigned students to consume the Colbert Report. And those students who self-reported being conservative were just as likely to find Colbert funny as the liberals. But it was their interpretation of the humor that was different. This is what got me starting to think about this idea of different humor structures being aligned with different ideological minds. Because these conservatives in this particular experiment, they interpreted Colbert as being just an exaggerator, presenting a heightened version of his own actual opinion. As opposed to people on the left who accurately perceive that he was ironically presenting the opposite opinion of what he actually holds.
And satire is such a, as you both are describing, a not just a delicate balance, but a very pointed sword, it seems to
me.
I mean, because looking at Colbert, the way he skewers people is so deft.
Right. And there are these wonderful quotes that come from these scholars of satire and irony. Henri Bergson, the Frenchman, who wrote, you know, decades ago, talked about irony as a gap between what is real and what is ideal. Mm-hmm. And I think Colbert does that very thing by presenting what is real as though it is his ideal. And we're supposed to guess that he believes the opposite.
He also does something interesting on his show. Unlike Jon Stewart, who will break from his character and laugh every now and then, Colbert will not. He plays it straight, which does not give the audience the cues to laugh or the cues to understand when he's kidding and when he's not.
You have to know from the get-go.
You do.
Well, we're going to play a clip of Colbert, and this is actually a relatively recent clip, and he was talking about a meeting of conservatives and makes a comment about, or what we hear is a joke on Rick Santorum's comment about smart people. Let's listen.
Take a load off. I don't know about you, but I had a beautiful weekend. I was down in Washington, D.C., for the Conservative Values Voter Summit. Not exactly a gala affair. For some reason, the group fighting to deny gay people rights has trouble finding a competent party planner. But I'll tell you this, it is a great place to hear from prominent conservative voices like Jan Brewer, Kirk Cameron, Eric Cantor, and a 9mm firing at a disc of birth control pills. But folks, only one speaker down there really appealed to the voters' hearts and, well, just hearts.
We will never have the media on our side, ever, in this country. We will never have the elite, smart people on our side.
Yes. He is right. It is high time the GOP stop trying to appeal to smart people. And letting Rick Santorum in front of a microphone is a great place to start.
And that's a classic Stephen Colbert. And there's something about that voice and the way he uses his voice, Allison.
There is. I mean, he sounds like a pundit. He's created and crafted this persona based entirely on a cable news pundit. And
it's Papa Bear.
Papa Bear. Oh, and it's so similar that it's really sometimes hard to distinguish what's real and what's not.
What do you hear there, Dana?
Yeah, I was just going to say what I think is interesting about Colbert and how people interpret it. It is a really complex set of mental gymnastics from a cognitive standpoint to understand the Colbert Report. I mean, if you haven't had a good night's sleep, or like me, your two-year-old daughter was up at 4:30 in the morning
there
for no apparent reason, it's very difficult for you to have the frontal lobe cognitive capacity to decipher what he's saying, particularly in his segment The Word, where he's on one side of the screen, he's saying something, and then there's this meta voice, maybe the voice of a liberal conscience, I don't know, sometimes not. And that voice comes in text on the opposite side of the screen. That is a very difficult thing to process.
For human beings to process
yes.
that information, not just sleepy moms.
Correct.
And apparently it's very difficult to write as well, because I interviewed Alison Silverman, who's the former executive producer and writer at Colbert, and she said that writing for that show was like driving down the highway in reverse. And just when you think you have to go right in order to get off the highway, you really have to go left.
That is awesome.
Yeah. It was really fascinating. Yeah.
But I find, and maybe it's not just getting a good night's sleep, but also the more you know about what's going on in the news or who said what, the better the satire is.
That's absolutely true. What a lot of the people that I interviewed said was, look, we're not here to educate people. In fact, you can't watch our show. You can't watch the monologues and hear the political stuff without having a pre-existing knowledge mm-hmm. of politics to begin with. And in fact, I interviewed Mark Maron, who's a comedian, and he said, look, most of the American public doesn't like political humor. Their eyes are going to roll into the back of their head. They're going to fall asleep. So the people that seek out political comedy already understand. They have that base knowledge to begin with.
That's true.
Makes sense to you, Don?
Yeah. I think that one of the things that we find when you do experiments to test whether or not people learn from political humor is you can actually acquire factual information about like current events. Mm-hmm. You can become aware that something happened, for example. It's more difficult to acquire what we call like civics knowledge, which mm-hmm. is, you know, who is the vice president of the United States and how does a bill become a law and things like that. However, you can also acquire a different kind of understanding of politics in terms of sort of like a normative understanding of political life. What is right? What is wrong? What is the role of government? What isn't? But that's very hard to measure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm also thinking, and then we'll move on to some callers, and we have a clip from John Stewart's program. But I'm also thinking under Colbert that the better know a district where these members of Congress, one wonders whether, do they know what they've got themselves into, or are they just playing along with the joke? But that seems to me is a very bipartisan critique that Stephen Colbert is
absolutely.
Doing.
Absolutely. I think Allison was going
to go ahead, Allison.
Well, most congressmen have been warned not to do that anymore. And in fact, those segments are rare now.
That map is not particularly filled up yet.
Exactly right. Because the early ones were so damning. I mean, they were so brutal to watch as well that it was a bipartisan critique.
Yeah.
I would say at the same time that, you know, it depends on the lens through which you're looking at this. I think Stephen Colbert plays a character who is so sure he's right, regardless of what he knows he doesn't know. And if you interpret it that way, even when he is exposing hypocrisies and a lack of knowledge on the part of these congresspeople, he is still suggesting that there's a better alternative out there, and he's not it. His sort of conservative pundit style is not definitely going to get us to the bottom of truth. But there's something else that's better that's possible that we should reach for. Like, why are these people who don't know anything in office, for example? Those are the kinds of questions that we're forced to ask.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get to some callers. And that's Dani Young. She's an assistant professor at the University of Delaware, a fellow at the Center for Political Communication. Allison Dagnes is an associate professor of political science at Shippensburg University, and her book has gotten us thinking about and talking about political humor from the left and the right. Her book is A Conservative Walks Into a Bar, The Politics of Political Humor. And we have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get a couple of callers, then we'll play a clip from The Daily Show. First, we've got Kavita from Bethlehem. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
I was just going to bring up, so I probably lean liberal, left, progressive, but when I watched Clint Eastwood's speech at the Republican National Convention, I actually laughed quite a bit. And there was definitely sort of an uproar. Before I even heard the speech, I had read about it and how it didn't make sense, or it wasn't funny, or, you know, that he didn't know what he was doing and he was off the deep end. And then I actually watched the whole thing, and I found it pretty well put together and kind of funny as sort of an improv piece. And so I guess I wanted to bring that up because I think, it, you know, what you were saying earlier about the bias you have, you want to see things that you believe, and then it confirms your bias, and then it's funnier to you.
Yes.
And I think liberals and conservatives have the same issue, which is that looking for things that just confirm, you know, and yes, political satire can make us all question things, but I think sometimes even liberals who like to question things, if it questions something that I believe in, I'm not going to find it funny anymore. And that's what I saw happening with the reaction to the speech.
Well, I appreciate the call, Kavita, to Radio Times. I'm going to toss that to you, Danigo, because you do improv. Was that a good piece of improv?
I don't know if he was improvised or if he was sleep deprived. I'm not sure. I don't know. I think what the caller is getting at, though, is interesting about, you know, she had heard about it. She had heard it was awful, and then she watched it. She thought it was pretty good. I wonder, though, if she may have had some kind of cognitive dissonance that many people on the left had when they heard that Clint Eastwood had done a piece that was pretty scathing about President Obama. There might have been some kind of confirmation bias going into her processing of that piece in the first place, because she might have been thinking, wait, was it? Does he really not support the president to such an extent that he would do this challenging of a piece? So I'm not sure.
But do we always bring our prejudices and our preconceived notions? I mean, are some things, can some things just be objectively good or bad, do you think, Allison?
I always like to think that humor is a taste. It's a sense. And so we're going to find different things funny. But I do think that we bring our own opinions and our own beliefs in. It's the idea that if you don't like sushi, if someone says, here's sushi, you're not going to find it as attractive as if someone says, here, try this, and you taste it, and you don't know what it is. So when you're looking at...
You should tell my husband that.
Quick, get him on the phone. But I think that if you're looking at the Republican National Convention, then you're going into this with an idea, a preconceived notion of what's going to be said, and that is definitely going to color your opinion of things.
Let's see what Deborah from Germantown has to say. And Deborah, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have been fascinated. This is Deborah. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
I've been interested in the way that social media, I think, is in some ways blurring the line of what is political satire. I feel like the person who's more than twice a week checking things on Snopes and making a comment on Facebook to say, no, Mitt Romney did not say that this about blacks. This is something from a satirist. And it's fascinating to me that it's links get forwarded. People don't, like, look at the bottom and, you know, see the about line. So I wonder if you've seen any of the, you know, the ability of Twitter and Facebook to forward things that get promoted as fact, when in fact, you know, it's Borowitz. It's just, it's satire.
I hear you. Deborah, let me see what Allison says.
The number of times that I have students or even friends who will say, oh my gosh, did you see this? This is amazing. And it turns out it's from The Onion.
Right.
That is incredible. Because we are so quick now with social media. Everything's so rapid. And so we'll read something and we'll just pass it along. And there was a congressman, a Republican congressman, who got into trouble with that. There was people had posted on Facebook an Onion piece that said that Planned Parenthood was going to start an abortionplex. And he freaked out and just started condemning Planned Parenthood up one side and down the other. And the folks at The Onion said, we are so happy that instead of reading the real news, you are reading our newspaper instead.
Wow.
But it isn't real.
Wow. Dana?
Yeah, that's funny. Going back to what you had said before about, go back 1 second. What did you just said?
About the rapid nature of social media.
Yeah. Okay, so, this is good. This is good. Thank you.
Is that how improv works?
It is, yeah. I'll talk about that after. But the idea that social media can serve to sort of fuel the speed of this process, mm-hmm. one of the goals of FlackCheck.org, which is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, directed by Kathleen Hall Jamieson, it's a sister site of the more sort of serious buttoned up factcheck.org. But, and you have to say it like that when you say it. But FlackCheck, which kind of sounds like Affleck, but anyway, FlackCheck is designed to do the same thing as FactCheck, but through satire, parody, and entertaining videos that are in small, bite sized chunks so they can be shared online, et cetera. Mm-hmm. 30 second clips that take on these myths or misperceptions that are being advanced through political campaign material.
Yeah. Do you think it's any more, I don't want to get you in trouble here, any more effective, FlackCheck versus FactCheck?
Well, you know what, Marty? Thank you for asking that question, and I didn't set you up for that. But I actually did a series of experiments this summer, and it looks like, to some extent, we have parody of the effects. So FlackCheck.org seemed to be as effective in some circumstances as FactCheck in terms of debunking those myths. What's really important, though, is that I don't know how many people will read factcheck.org, but I think you might have a lot of people for whom the humorous videos will be more accessible and more entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense to you, Allison?
It does. It does. And going back to Deborah's point about social media sort of blurring this line, it is really fast, but that speed can lead us to something else. And I'll give you an example. I subscribe to the Borowitz Report, and so I may not have cued into the news when I will get a posting from the Borowitz Report. I had one about the Todd Akin abortion rape statement, and I hadn't heard about it yet because I had been teaching. And so once I saw that Borowitz Report, I thought, well, I don't understand what this is. And I went to the New York Times and went, oh, now I understand what this is. So there is a benefit to that speed that it can cue you into some education there, too.
In a way that is really informative and interesting. That's one of the outcomes that we find of political humor across the board is subsequent information seeking through more traditional news sources or online, which is intuitive, but it's nice to have the evidence that does happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. We're going to play some more clips as well, talking with Danigal Young. Danny Young, assistant professor at the University of Delaware. She does improv, a comedy, and she also, as she was describing, contributes to FlackCheck.org. Also with us is Allison Dagnus, an associate professor of political science at Shippensburg University, and we've been talking about her new book, A Conservative Walks Into a Bar, The Politics of Political Humor. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY McCarter Theater in Princeton, New Jersey. Presenting Christopher Durang's newest play, Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, set in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. On a farmhouse in the country, siblings have their hands full with a prophetic cleaning woman, a costume party, and a surprise visit. Starring Sigourney Weaver and David Hyde Pierce, Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike at McCarter Theater in Princeton. Now through October 14th. More information at McCarter.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. How will security at U.S. embassies change post-Benghazi, and will it defeat the purpose of diplomacy to build fortresses? Also, cults post-Sun Myung Moon. Former Mooney and cult expert Stephen Hassan weighs in. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health supports WHYY and offers a fully accredited master's degree in public health. An open house will be held Thursday, September 27th in the Blumley Life Sciences Building, 233 South 10th Street. Registration by phone, 215-503-0174, or online at jefferson.edu. The Jefferson School of Population Health, committed to bringing health and healthcare together.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are talking about political humor, political satire. And let me play another clip. This goes back to the Democratic National Convention, and Jon Stewart's team of reporters talked to a number of the people who attended the convention, and this is a segment that they called Hope and Change to the Party of Inclusion. Let's listen.
Tolerance. It's one of the basic tenets of the Democratic Party. But is there truly room for everyone under the DNC's big tent? The best news team has more.
There's one key message at the Democratic Convention that's just not in dispute.
We are the Big Ten Party. We represent everyone.
We're definitely the arms wide open party.
We are the party of inclusion.
We have just about everybody you can possibly imagine in the party.
Yes, they were open to everybody.
Basically, we're Latinos, Hispanics, we're blacks, we're the LGBT community, we're women, we're poor.
Everyone's welcome.
Everyone's welcome.
Except?
Except unless you own a corporation or if you're a hunter, a gun owner, white males.
Really? You want to lose all the white males?
They're a bunch of gun-toting hillbilly tea partiers, that's all I have to say. Bang, 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 bang.
Right. Bunch of jerk-offs, right?
Definitely.
How open are you?
Well, open enough to include everybody.
Oh, really? Who wouldn't you include?
We wouldn't include those beer-toting fakers down in Florida. The Tampa Convention guys.
You know the types.
Pot-bellied.
Church-going.
Small-minded.
Anti-science.
It's a bunch of 70 Sam Hillbilly.
Whack job, evangelical, gun nuts.
They don't want to hear a message of difference and of hope.
What can you and I teach these whack jobs about inclusion? You go first.
You can't teach them anything.
Don't have a clue about science. Very questionable on any kind of thought that involves more than two or three sentences.
We are the Big Ten Party, and we will let most anybody in unless, of course, they're carrying guns.
Right. Who needs that 146 million people in your party?
Well, what can I say? That is classic a Daily Show. And talk about reporters being enablers. But I think... made a very important point. Do you want to take that, Allison?
They did. I mean, one of the important points for me is that this shows that there really isn't a liberal bias in political satire because they're shooting at the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. If they cared so much about the left, then they would not do this. I mean, I think that the greatest attribute of political satirists and comedians today is their ability to pivot and just take fire at everybody. And that's a really important gift. That's something that shows that they are more concerned with making people laugh than they are with making a bigger point about something.
I don't know that I'd agree with that, though, because I think that they're taking aim at the Democrats, but that the underlying ideological message that they are advancing through this series of interviews is that a true liberal will embrace diversity in all of its forms. You know what I mean? I'm just getting meta here for a second.
Including the gun toters.
Exactly.
And all
that if you're really truly liberal in the sense that, you know, you believe in tolerance and diversity, you will not be as judgmental and close-minded about the differences across the aisle.
That's true. But if you're a partisan, you're certainly not going to take aim at your own party.
True. Oh, that's true. That's true. So it might be an issue of an ideological leaning, but not necessarily like a party alliance.
I would go with that.
Yeah.
But I think what makes it effective is that you're not putting words in those people's mouth. They are, in a sense, hanging themselves with their own words.
Absolutely.
Which is, as a viewer, it was both hilarious, but also so almost shocking to watch.
Mm-hmm. And funny.
One of the things that I think that just the massive amount of media that we have available to us now enables people like Colbert and Stewart to mine footage to be able to piece together a narrative that advances their own view of what's going on. And so this is a little bit different because they're doing these interviews, but it's the same kind of idea that they're using someone else's words to sort of expose this underlying reality.
Well, let's get back to our callers. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. It looks like we have Gary from Delaware joining us on Radio Times. And Gary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yep. Your comments that you just made are a great segue for what I had planned to say. If either of you are old enough to remember the Smothers Brothers back in the 60s, early 70s, they didn't leave anybody immune. The right and the left, they picked Owen Johnson just as much as Nixon, and their political satire, I mean, it hit everything right on target.
And they paid a kind of a price for that as well, Gary. Do you want to take that, Allison?
Sure. It's a great point. Satire has been around since in America, since America has existed, even before then. And what I found in going back and looking at the political humor and the political commentary from the revolutionary period to today is that it really has mirrored the times. It has mirrored the politics that are going on. And so you look at the Smothers Brothers, this was during the sort of tumult of the 1960s, and there was a lot of anti-establishment mood out there already, and they were on TV doing it. They did pay a price for it, but what they were doing was really reflecting a larger cultural idea that was happening.
Dana?
One of the things that is interesting about examining the case of the Smothers Brothers and how they went off the air, I think a lot of people will try to draw parallels between them and then what happened to Bill Maher on politically
incorrect.
I'm sorry, thank you. I'm like, it's not politically correct.
Incorrect.
It's incorrect. Okay.
Yes.
Was that what happened with the Smothers Brothers was clearly something where they had frustrated the powers that be and the political power holders who had a direct line to the executives of their network to be able to pull the plug. What happened with Bill Maher was very different, and it reflects a very different time period, because what happened with Bill Maher was a result of sponsors pulling and advertisers pulling. That's just an interesting, different dynamic of the time. But satire often can go too far, at which point there are repercussions.
Well, and even going back to the Bill Maher comment, this was after September 11th, and I remember comics sort of asking themselves and maybe the rest of us, you know, when can we laugh again? Seems kind of pretentious, but nonetheless, people were obviously in deep mourning and tragedy, and the question was, you know, when can we have
satire?
When can we be funny?
And how can we be funny? And Allison does a nice job summarizing how The Onion took on that very issue, because The Onion and The Daily Show did sort of a wonderful job post 9/11. If you want to talk about that.
They sure, did. I mean, at the time, people were saying irony was dead. There was just this real lack of humor and comedy that was out there. And most of the people that I interviewed who were working at the time said that in New York, people waited until David Letterman went back on the air. And then they went back on the air. Mm-hmm. But The Onion and The Daily Show really tapped into their own grief.
Yeah.
And instead of just waka waka, I mean, it really was this sort of heartfelt, very sad sense of discussion that was going on.
I remember reading the Onion headline and just thinking, oh my God, I'm a punchline. Because the Onion headline was, "Woman not knowing what else to do bakes American flag cake." And I read that as I was about, 22, 23, 24 years old? I had made an American flag collage out of various pieces of crepe paper. I mean, this was before I was, like, married and had kids, so, you know, I had time to make an American flag out of crepe paper.
And money.
Apparently. But I was like, I remember reading that headline and saying, this is funny because it's so real, because we have no idea what to do with this grief.
Mm-hmm. And another headline you include, Allison, is hijackers surprised to find selves in hell, which I think is a pretty brilliant headline.
Absolutely. I don't know if you remember The Daily Show in that first show afterwards when Jon Stewart was crying.
Yeah, he was grieving.
It was so moving. And then he said, we're going to go on and we're going to have skits that have absolutely no political value whatsoever. You know, we're not going to make fun of anybody else. Saturday Night Live took months to do anything that was political. It was very light. It was just supposed to be kind of above partisanship and above politics.
Interesting. Right? Let me see what Gene from Cinnaminson has to say. Gene, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Gene.
Hi, are you still there?
Yes, are you still there? Go ahead.
Yes, I'm still here.
Go ahead.
What about the possibility that the reason conservatives think that Colbert is conservative is not that they're biased, but that the conservative mind just doesn't get irony. When I talk to conservatives, they don't get that kind of humor.
Well, that's interesting, and I have to say, Dana's jumping up and down here.
Jean!
Go ahead, Dana.
Friend, how are you? So I have gotten in arguments about this with people across the aisle, but I'm going to tell you in a snippet here. There is some evidence that points to the fact that what you're saying is true, and the evidence comes from these really fancy fMRI studies, neuropsychology studies of cognitive psychology at NYU that have been going on the last 10 years, where they're looking at the brain structures and functioning of liberals versus conservatives, and they find some amazing things. They find a larger amygdala among conservatives, meaning you have a higher threat response, mortality, and your own death is very salient to you. They find larger anterior cingulate cortexes among liberals, which means that you are better able to navigate uncertain situations. There's also been studies, also from this team at NYU, that look at aesthetic preferences among liberals and conservatives, finding that liberals are far more likely to appreciate things that are abstract, like abstract art, plays that don't have a happy ending, etc. And they tie that back to a personality trait or psychological trait called need for closure. People who need things tied up in a knot at the end, that trait correlates very strongly with a conservative ideology. So all that is to say, Jean, that I'm in the middle of putting together this elaborate argument that says that what you're saying is right, and that it is irony is something that is just the natural pairing with a liberal mind. An exaggeration, where you heighten an existing reality, that is something that's a natural pairing, I believe, with a conservative mind.
Interesting. Allison, makes sense. Jean, thanks for the call.
It makes a lot of sense to me. And something that I found in my interviews, because I started asking people, I didn't know how to interview, and so I had worked at C-SPAN for 5 years, and I watched Brian Lamb interview, and he always asks, where'd you go to college? And so I figured, okay, he's great, so I'll just do what he does. And so I asked people, where'd you go to college? What was your major? And what I found of the 30-something people I interviewed, no one was a political science major. No matter how political their material was, they were all performing arts majors or something else. A couple, a handful were like engineering. And what that led me to believe was exactly, I think, moving in the direction of your research, Dana, which is that if you are a performing arts kind of person, then that may mean, with all of these other big brain things that you're doing, that you're going to lean towards being more liberal than if you pick a different major. And from there, it's really a lot about personality type.
Right. Let me go back a couple of years, because I know on Fox there was an effort to put a kind of a daily show.
The half-hour news hour,
obviously playing off the PBS news hour. It didn't work.
15 episodes. It lasted 15 episodes.
Did you ever watch it?
I did.
And I
interviewed also one of the writers from the half-hour news hour. And it didn't work for a multitude of reasons. And I'll give you two of, I think, the biggest. One is, it's really hard to do comedy on a news channel. And even CNN has tried to do, they did a D.L. Hughley show. I mean, it just doesn't work. When you tune into Fox News, you are expecting punditry, which we could debate whether or not that's actually supposed to be funny or not, and news. Same thing with CNN. And so having comedy on a news channel is going to be difficult. But the second thing is that I think that they started that to be the conservative version of The Daily Show. And when you start out trying to be the conservative or the liberal something, that is going to squash.
Air America.
There we go.
Right?
I mean, it's going to squash. It's going to squash your humor.
Which was the idea of a liberal channel.
It was supposed to be, a liberal response to, like, the Limbaughs out there and the dominance of political talk radio that was conservative, and it just didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Let me get, looks like Mark from Ambler joining us on Radio Times. Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. One of the things that I find most enjoyable in terms of political humor that gets very little attention is the Capitol Steps.
Mm.
I've listened to them for years. I don't know if you folks know who they are.
Sure. Yes.
But, I've enjoyed them, and what I kind of attribute that to is I don't get the feeling that they're mean-spirited. I get the feeling, and I don't get the feeling they're out to promote an agenda or attack anyone, that their goal is to make people laugh.
Right.
And that their work and the way they present their materials entails a far higher degree of creativity and talent than just telling jokes or doing skits.
Mark, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and we're getting enthusiastic nods here. Do you want to take that, Allison?
I love the Capitol Steps. They're just a wonderful, they do parody, musical parody. And I interviewed Elena Newport, who's one of the founders of the Capitol Steps. They've been around for 30 years. And she was just telling me that the goal, again, is to be funny. They will take what's in the news, they will turn it into a song, but the song has to be easily accessible, mm-hmm. just like the joke has to be easily accessible. And therefore, really, they're not taking partisan pot shots. Yeah. They're trying to be humorous mm-hmm. to a wider audience that is interested in politics. And that is no easy feat. But I'm a huge fan of them as well.
That is, it's just such a different agenda than something like a traditional satirist who will say that they have an itch and they're trying to scratch it and this is how they do it. The Capitol Steps is not itchy, right?
Right.
And they kind of remind me of the same spirit of humor that we saw in Bob Hope with his OSO shows, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that was often very political in the sense that there were political topics and political people who were involved. But they were never the sort of mean-spirited object of the joke. And they also, those kinds of jokes never delved too far into questioning institutions or policies, really, right? They were really about maybe scandal, maybe famous politicians.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. We're almost out of time here, but I was surprised and pleased to see that you also looked at Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, a show I enjoy.
Yeah,
but you included that as you wrote about the Daily Show and
I
Colbert.
Did. I have a friend who
you
said...
You a big smile on your face when you're saying that.
I do. A friend of mine said, this is just a gambit for you to meet all the people you have a crush on. And I said, yes, it is. So I met Peter Sagal, and he was wonderful. I mean, I think that Wait, Wait does a really good job of trying to bring humor and light to some very difficult mm-hmm. topics. But he was terrific. It's a great show.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Alice Dagnes, an associate professor of political science at Shippensburg University, author of A Conservative Walks Into a Bar, The Politics of Political Humor. Danny Young, assistant professor at the University of Delaware. She's part of an improv comedy group called Comedy Sports here in Philadelphia, and she contributes to FlackCheck.org. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out about this program. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, with assistance this week from Jonathan Best. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. And coming up,